I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway, and it's great to have you with us. Before we start today's show, I want to let you know that this segment will be focusing on sexual assault. In the past few years, we've witnessed how powerful institutions, including the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, and others, have hidden decades of sexual abuse towards boys and young men. And while many of those institutions have faced consequences ranging from changes in leadership to lawsuits, those consequences can't erase the shame and suffering many of the victims faced. It's something we don't talk a lot about in this country. And yet sexual assault of boys and young men is much more pervasive than we might expect. According to the Washington Post, as many as 1 in 6 boys say they experienced sexual abuse during their childhoods. Today on The Takeaway, we explore the crisis of sexual abuse towards boys and young men and what we can do to stop it. Emma Brown is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post and the author of the forthcoming book, To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. Emma, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Richard Gartner is a psychologist and psychoanalyst and the co-founder of Male Survivor, a national organization preventing and healing the sexual victimization of boys and men. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Tommy Curry is a professor of philosophy at the University of Edinburgh. Tommy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Emma, how common is the sexual assault of boys and young men?
Well, as I learned in my reporting, it is as many as 1 in 6 boys who are sexually assaulted or abused before they reach age 18. But the number, the number is hard to tell because sexual assault reporting for anybody, is many people who are victims don't report, and the number of boys who report being sexually assaulted sort of varies depending on the survey. But one leading researcher I spoke to said, whatever the number is, it's a lot higher than we think it is, and we need to take action. So he felt like it was less important to know the specific percentage than for people to understand that this is an often hidden problem.
Tommy, you've researched the prevalence of sexual assault among Black boys and men specifically. What do we know about that?
Oh, well, we know the data shows us that we've had evidence that Black boys have been sexually victimized at very early ages, sometimes as young as 7 and 9, since the 1950s. A lot of the early racist discourse was built on the idea that poor Black boys were sexually promiscuous. So lots of white sociologists used to document that Black boys became sexually active at a very, very young age with older women. The studies that we've done, we're looking at actual survivors, men who were victims of child sexual victimization, and trying to gather some of their stories. And even in 2018, when we completed our study, we saw some overlap with that age range, that lots of Black boys in the United States are having their first sexual experience, usually with much older women as early as the age of 9. And of course, that's continuing until their average age of sexual debut, which is usually before their 14th or 15th birthday.
And Richard, Tommy was just talking about particularly the incidences of sexual abuse against young Black boys who are often hypersexualized themselves and often, interestingly, sexually abused by older women. Does that pattern play out for the other boys and young men that you have worked with?
Absolutely. Sexual abuse of boys happens in every socioeconomic class, so I want to be clear about that. And the boys at greatest risk are those living with neither or only one parent, those whose parents are separated, divorced, and or remarried, and those whose parents abuse alcohol or are involved in criminal behavior, and those who are non-white, as Tommy said, of lower socioeconomic status and under 13 years of age.
And Richard, is that one of the reasons why this doesn't get as much attention as we would assume it does, especially if we were talking about sexual assault against young women and girls?
I think the real reason is has to do with masculine gender socialization. All boys, no matter what socioeconomic group they are from, learn how to be masculine. And unfortunately, one of the things that they consider to be unmasculine is being a victim. And so they are very, very unlikely to disclose what happened.
Emma, do we have a sense for where this happens? We know it happens across class lines, but are there areas or locations that where we see this happening more?
You know, I think we see it happening in all different kinds of places, happening in rural places, urban, suburban, happening in schools, private schools that are hard to get into, and happening, you know, in public schools that anybody can go to. So I think, as Richard said, it spans socioeconomic class. It also spans geography. I mean, there was one, really, I think, important study that sort of underlines what Dr. Curry was saying about the victimization of Black boys. It was a study of the number of boys who had sexual experiences before they were 13. And in that study, Black boys were much more likely to have been to have had an early sexual experience. And of course, you can't consent when you're under 13. And in that study, the incidence of this kind of early sexual experience varied widely across cities. So it was like 5% of boys in San Francisco compared to 25% in Memphis. So I think my takeaway from that is it can happen anywhere, but it may be perhaps more concentrated in some places than others.
Tommy, when you hear that, does that connect with the research that you've seen?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, there are several studies that have been published in the last decade, Bellio and other authors, that really do show that Black boys have the earliest sexual debut of any race sex group in the United States. Again, I want to be very clear. The first cohort of Black boys that usually report the highest sexual debut is between the ages of 12 and 14. The second is between 9 and 12. So that means between 9 and 14, you have many Black boys, at least in the survey data, suggesting that they're having their first sexual experience well before they're able to consent. So what often happens is that we're numb to the fact that we have many young Black men in this society who are telling you that their first sexual debut was actually an act of statutory rape. And again, this data has been around for decades. It was even the basis of lots of racist suppositions about Black male hypersexuality and hypersexualization. The problem is that we have not defined or allowed Black men to be victims, that even though we know this, and we know that it's as a public health crisis in many ways, we refuse to acknowledge the data or even their narratives because we see Black men as predators. And it's that racist construction or caricature of Black males that do not allow us as a society to take their victimization and their rape seriously.
Richard, how much of this is also, you know, we know that young girls are often taught to be fearful, to be protective of their quote unquote private parts, to, you know, say if they're, understand the differences between bad touch and good touch. Do we do the same for boys? Do we, are boys aware at least of what good touch versus bad touch is? And do we have similar conversations with boys so that they can detect when something is off?
I think it's pretty rare that boys have that conversation with their parents. The parents don't even think about it, more or less. The parents, what they do teach them is that boys are resilient and competitive, that they're mentally and physically tough, independent, all of the things that make boys not want to define themselves as sexual victims. So the average age of in studies I know, as opposed to the ones that Tommy was just saying, that the average age, median age for first abusive contact is age 9. And it can go down to infants.
And that we mentioned the numbness to that as a society we have. Emma, do you In your research and reporting this, Div, have you found that as well, that we are sort of numb as a society to the pain at, that sexual abuse toward young boys and men could have?
Absolutely. And it was one of the most sort of shocking and profoundly affecting parts of my research for my book, was realizing the ways in which boys' pain is dismissed or not acknowledged. And I'll just give one example of a boy who was a middle school boy who was sexually assaulted during his music class at his school in Oklahoma. And the principal and the superintendent later admitted in the course of an investigation that had the same thing happen to a girl, they would have considered it sexual assault, but they just didn't see it as sexual assault. They saw it as horseplay because it was a boy, you know, this young boy was a boy. And so, you know, I think that was such a statement to me about the different ways that we see assault against boys versus assault against girls.
And I would imagine, Emma, that that makes it more difficult for the boys themselves to identify something happening to them.
Absolutely. And that's why I think what Richard said about, and what you said about sort of the necessity to tell our boys, tell our sons and boys we care for, that their bodies are their own, is so important.
Is that not happening enough right now, Emma?
I think it's not. I mean, I think that parents I talk to about this are surprised often to when they start thinking about, of course, we should tell our boys this, right? But it's not something that is quite in the air in the same way the conversation about talking to girls about the sanctity of their body is in the air.
And Richard, how do we get this into the broader conversation? I mean, obviously, we're talking about it on this show, but how do we get this to be at a place where we are now with women and sexual assault, for example?
Well, I think, you know, the men are at least 20 or 30 years behind women in terms of a public acknowledgement of this tragedy. I think what happens is every time there is something in the media, whether it is a show like this, or a trial like Jerry Sandusky at Penn State, or if a celebrity of some sort comes forward, and there have been many in recent years, and musicians like Santana, athletes like R.A. Dickey or Greg Lukianis, or performers and actors like Gabriel Byrne or Antoine Fisher, every time one of them comes forward, then there is a man out there or a boy out there who thinks, oh, someone who's a model in some way for me had this happen to him and is brave enough to come forward and to define it as abuse. Maybe I can too. And that's a big first step to getting help.
Tommy, this type of abuse can have long-lasting effects. Tell us about that.
Our studies have shown lots of different effects, pathways to mental illness, low self-esteem, higher risk of promiscuous sexual activities, a child before the age of 21. The narratives that we found from victims align pretty closely with the previous data that we've had for other sexual victims throughout the decades. I think when you're looking at Black men, especially poor Black men, there's also this psychological impact of invisibility, of disposability, that the world doesn't care about you. Lots of our subjects that we studied didn't even think about what happened to them as sexual violence or rape. In order to get them to make that connection, we had to put in a question that said, if this happened to a girl, a young girl, would you see this as rape? And practically all of them said absolutely. So there's a disconnect where they don't see the world being able to explain, much less care about them being sexual victims to older women, or in some cases men. So they carry this trauma around with them that manifests itself in depression, low self-esteem, hopelessness, with really no way to address or remedy it.
Richard, you help men through these types of traumas. You help them deal and come to terms with it and maybe find some semblance of peace. When you hear what Tommy is saying, tell us about how that plays out in the work that you do with the men that you're working with.
Well, these effects on boys, if they're not addressed in childhood or adolescence or even young adulthood, they go underground and they affect him so that they very likely to have a wide range of symptoms, often not knowing that they were sexually abused. They have not defined it that way. But alcoholism, drug abuse, addiction to pornography or sexual contact, overeating, shopping, even gambling, all of those are likely aftermath. And it's only when men have really hit close to rock bottom that they are likely to seek some kind of treatment. And the fact is that even though that many men say that the victimization did not matter to them, they come to therapy in larger numbers than men who did not have that history.
And do they say the victimization didn't matter because they were socialized to believe that it didn't matter? I think men, in the way that we create masculinity in this country, are sometimes encouraged to be sexually active long before they may want to be.
Well, that's right. And there's very little room for a boy who is anxious about what's happening to tell somebody, because especially if it's a woman that is assaulting him, if he tells his friend is likely to say, "You're lucky." Many adults would say, "You're lucky." And then he has nowhere to go with his anxiety, and then he just feels bad about himself.
Emma, how do you begin to approach a conversation about consent with boys, with young boys?
Well, I think, you know, with very young children, you talk about your body being your own and other people's bodies being their own. And as children get older, you can be more explicit about what that means. But two professors from Columbia, one of whom has since left Columbia, Jennifer Hirsch and Seamus Khan, wrote a book called Sexual Citizens, in which they put forth this concept of sexual citizenship, which I really like and sort of use now when I think about how to talk to my son. And it's the concept not sort of no means no or yes means yes, but that we all have we all have dignity, and we all deserve respect, and sort of a positive way to think about that issue of consent, both in terms of, you know, how boys can think about how they want to protect their own bodies, but also how they can think about interacting with someone else's body when they get to that point.
Tommy, I'm wondering, there may be men who are listening to this broadcast and maybe thinking, it may be bringing up some very difficult memories for them. How do we support men who have been the victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, particularly when they were young? What do you recommend?
You know, it's a difficult question because these symptoms and the way they tell their narratives manifest in a lot of different ways. I think the first thing is we have to understand that men are sexually vulnerable. This is a big part of the work that I've been doing, especially with Black men, given, you know, the kind of racist caricatures of them as being perpetrators and not victims. But the idea of sexual vulnerability, that being male means that you can, in fact, be sexually coerced, be made to penetrate, and have unwanted sexual contact at a very early age. The next thing is that I think that you have to listen to their stories and to their particular experiences. As a society, I think we're very hostile to the idea that men can be sexual victims. And I think as we work through different socioeconomic and racial groups, we become even more hostile to the point of deniability, where we want to fit them into certain boxes. So we need movements, we need educators, we need clinicians that are able to better help the society see that the experiences, the early sexual debut that these men have, are really important, and they're formative, right? They impact their psychology, they impact them throughout their life course. And lastly, is I think that we need movements like Me Too and other movements that are interested in sexual victims to come forward and actually start admitting the kind of prevalence we see, be it 12-month or lifetime prevalence in terms of male victims. Lots of racialized men, you know, Black men in the United States report some of the highest rates of prevalence for sexual victimization and made to penetrate violence in the country, but they're never centered as victims of sexual violence. So that narrative, that data, the way that we educate the society needs to fundamentally change.
Tommy Curry is a professor at the University of Edinburgh. Emma Brown is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post, and Dr. Richard Gartner is a psychologist and the co-founder of Male Survivor. Thank you all.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you can call RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE. That's 800-656-4673. More than 500,000 people have died from COVID-19 in the United States. It's a devastating and grim milestone. And as we mourn collectively as a nation, many of us continue to mourn individually for the friends and loved ones we dearly miss. And you've been sharing your memories with us.
Ike Rayford, Sioux City, Iowa. I'd like to remember Brady Hansen, Pam Bailey, and Cheryl Singleton, all of Sioux City, Iowa, or Northwest Iowa, and we just want to celebrate their life rather than their death due to this pandemic.
My name is Robin Scott in El Cerrito, California. I am mourning my friend Tim Lojeski. He was an activist. We met being an activist together in Florida in 2004, and he's so enthusiastic. I mean, he just was full of promise and opportunity, and things were going to absolutely turn around, and he was funny, and I just am so sorry that he missed. He died early of COVID. He got it, and they didn't take him to the hospital. They didn't test, you know, they tested him, but he didn't get his test. They didn't get the test results back until after he passed away. I'm just being as active as I can and doing as much as I can because I know that's what Tim would want me to do.
This is Bob from Springdale, Pennsylvania. As a way to honor essential workers as well as those that have suffered and died during this terrible pandemic, I've left my Christmas lights up. I call them COVID lights, and it's just a way to bring a little color and joy to the grayest of winters that we've suffered through.
Hello, Takeaway. As this grim number is reached of 500,000, my thoughts are as follows. We've lost 8 people who are close to us, because most of my friends and family are in the epicenter of the outbreak in northern Italy. In the States, we have 2 severely immunocompromised 4-year-olds, and so we've essentially been stuck in home since March. I mourn those that I've lost. I mourn our freedoms and interactions and being able to just hug people. I mourn the good sense that is lacking to be able to defeat this pandemic. Thank you.
This is Debbie Gallant in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, and I'm mourning my dad, Raymond Gallant, who died on January 27th as part of what I think of as the Christmas peak. He was just such a great guy and always really happy to answer the phone and hear my stories, my biggest cheerleader for 65 years, and the patriarch, the youngest of his generation. All his brothers and sisters and most of his friends were gone. And it's just so hard to be living in a world without him. Even though he was 91, and we know that people don't live forever, COVID took him earlier and took him in a crueler way than was necessary.
We're so grateful that you shared your stories with us, and we read and listen to everyone that you send, even those that don't make it to air, so thank you. Our inbox remains open for your remembrances. Email us a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Last week, super-rich YouTube influencer Logan Paul announced he was leaving California and moving to Puerto Rico. His main motivation? Avoiding what he sees as unnecessarily high taxes in the Golden State in favor of Puerto Rico's considerable tax breaks. But Paul is not alone. For years, the wealthy have swarmed to Puerto Rico to profit off of tax exemptions that don't extend to native Puerto Ricans. And while the island is still in an economic crisis, there are concerns that these types of investors will turn Puerto Rico into a gentrified tax haven for the rich. Joining me now to break this down is Yarimar Bonilla, professor of Puerto Rican studies at Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Yarimar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this. Is it a trend? Are we seeing a wave of rich, mostly folks from the mainland, moving to Puerto Rico post-Maria?
Well, I think there's been a new wave post-Maria, but really it started with the debt crisis. And as a result of certain measures that the local government put into place to attract newcomers to the island. And this was around the time when Wall Street stopped lending money to Puerto Rico and there was search for new ways of bringing influx of cash to the island.
Now, there are tax laws that are meant to incentivize investors to come to the island. What can you tell us about those?
So Puerto Rico has always been a kind of site for speculation and investment on the part of U.S. residents and Wall Street. So forever, Puerto Rico has been a place where there can be loopholes and ways of really tax dodging. It used to be mostly for companies that would come and set up shop and you know, be able to pay lower wages than in the U.S. and on top of it, not have to pay the same level of capital gains taxes. Now with this new law, this also extends to individuals. And the idea was that with a small number of very high net worth individuals, we could have a big influx of cash. But it has extended beyond a small number of high net worth individuals, and it's been growing and growing and having certain impacts on the island that folks are starting to become really worried about.
Yarimar, I had family members who worked for some of the major corporations that went to Puerto Rico decades ago to set up shop under the corporate tax haven laws that you mentioned. Some of those tax haven laws have since expired, haven't they?
Yes, with the and during the Clinton administration, they started to be slowly phased out, and that was a key part of what caused and triggered the debt crisis. And, you know, after those corporations left, you know, there are lots of parts of Puerto Rico that feel like ghost towns, you know, empty fabricas, you know, and those jobs have never really come back.
So now we're putting the onus on individual investors to come to the island. What we're hearing a lot, Yarimar, is that these folks are really going there and creating, essentially privatizing much of what Puerto Rico, you know, much of what's available on Puerto Rico and sort of taking advantage of the fact that the island is in such a delicate economic position. What are you seeing there?
It's good that you bring the word privatize because that really is, you know, a lot of what they're interested in. You know, these are folks that to a great extent kind of don't believe in government. You know, so for them, the island's weak government and its non-sovereign relationship to the United States is beneficial. You know, they don't like over, you know, too much regulation. They certainly don't like to pay taxes. And so, you know, they're folks that don't care, for example, if the roads aren't working, if there's not good health care, because they have the means to get around that, you know. But as they come, you know, they kind of don't contribute to the local coffers here in Puerto Rico. And so the folks who can't afford, for example, to turn their homes into a kind of self-sustaining solar powered bunker, you know, have to deal with the increases in utility services. The folks who can't afford to have, you know, 4x4s, who need, for example, public transportation, you know, they're the ones who are really going to pay the price of you know, the kind of weakening of the Puerto Rican state economy.
Yarimar, one of the things that is standing out to me is Puerto Rico is already a colony of the United States, and that colonial relationship with the United States is one that has been fraught for decades. The idea that mostly white, wealthy investors are coming to the island, to me, reeks of a new type of colonization of the island. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, just this week, one of our local legislators talked about this as a kind of tax apartheid. You know, there's this creation of two different societies, you know, and in some ways it feels like the kind of colonial settlement that that the U.S. was never really able to fully implement in Puerto Rico. You know, initially when the U.S. acquired the island, it changed the name to Puerto Rico. It tried to, you know, Americanize it, implement English in schools, et cetera. And there was a lot of pushback. And with the Commonwealth status, whatever one might think of it, you know, there was certainly a kind of strong push to maintain Spanish language and a kind of cultural distinctiveness, you know, to make up a word. But now it seems like there's finally a kind of settlement that is happening. And you see people really accommodating this these new American arrivals. And some of them think that we should speak English. You know, a lot of them want to really change what's here, you know, which is kind of the classic gentrification tale where they're attracted initially to the cultural diversity and, you know, what's different about Puerto Rico. Then as soon as they get here, they want to change it. And they have all these ideas about how to disrupt it, in to use the, you know, Silicon Valley speak, or to just, you know, transform it to better suit their needs.
Why, all while leaving out Puerto Ricans who are on the island?
Absolutely, you know, and they often, you know, and some in some things, of course, they are correct, you know, and nothing is, you know, black and white. So they do have a lot of concerns about government corruption, about the bureaucracy in Puerto Rico. All of that is true. But, you know, they don't have any interest in building greater autonomy for Puerto Rico, and certainly not in Puerto Rico becoming a state, because that would eliminate all these loopholes for them. So what is beneficial for them is for the for Puerto Rico to continue to be a colony. Like, colonialism benefits them. And, you know, I've interviewed some of these folks and I've asked them, you know, what it feels like to move to a colony, what it feels like to not be able to vote for the president, for example. And none of that really interests them, partly because, you know, for them, the way they influence politics is not at the ballot box, but by donating to campaigns. And that's something that that folks here are also worried about. You know, to what extent are they going to start donating to local politicians and really, you know, influencing public policy in a way that's disproportionate to their presence on the island, you know, to their demographics?
Yarimar, has this has the PROMESA Oversight Board, the Financial Oversight Board for Puerto Rico, encouraged this type of behavior? And what about the Governor Pedro Pierluisi?
Pedro Pierluisi has not made too many statements about these communities, you know, and in some ways, this was started, was the kind of brainchild of a previous pro-statehood administration under Fortuño. But, you know, it's been a kind of bipartisan thing here because it was put into place by a popular Democratic politician. It's really only been the pro-independence party that has spoken out, you know, consistently against them. So it's not really, you know, it kind of swings in multiple directions. The fiscal board has not said too much about them, but the IRS is looking into this program and, you know, has been carrying out investigations to see, first of all, if indeed these folks live here, because many of them, you know, they only have to live here for 6 months out of the year. And many of them really keep close track of that because they have no interest in staying not even one day past the 6 months. And a lot of them also are constantly looking for loopholes to not actually be here. Like, every time there's a disaster and there's a declaration of a disaster, they don't have to be here and they're quick to leave, you know, and they have all these apps and spreadsheets and different ways of tracking the very, you know, last hour they spent here. And so the IRS is interested in getting the funds that they're not getting from these folks.
Yarimar, what's happening to me, I mean, my family, I still have family on the island here on the Takeaway. We went to the island 1 year after the devastation of Hurricane Maria to do in-depth reporting on what was happening there. I already started noticing this shift happening then. But with gentrification, with white wealthy investors coming to the island, that also changes things culturally. And we saw that happen here in New York City with gentrification. where Black and brown communities were gentrified and then essentially, you know, almost disdained for living in their own communities. Is that playing out in Puerto Rico right now in terms of the cultural shifts that we're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. Some folks say, oh, we don't need to worry about this because these communities are concentrated in certain enclaves, and everyone talks about Dorado or Palmas del Mar, but they're expanding. You know, it's classic gentrification where you have the kind of quote unquote pioneers who begin to kind of create a safe community in little pockets where English is spoken, where you have, you know, English private schools, and they are able to create a community. But now people are moving to the edges of those communities and expanding out more and more because also they're finding good deals on land, you know, and post Maria, this has just increased, you know, and in many ways, Maria was a kind of global ad for Puerto Rico. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's cheap there and I can go and you know, take advantage of all these incentives and basically disaster capitalism.
Yarimar, are Puerto Ricans themselves taking back some of their land?
Well, they certainly would like to, but, you know, there is a debt crisis, there's an economic crisis, there's a housing crisis. And so not everyone can purchase, you know, a piece of beachfront property and pay for it all in cash, you know. So sellers will go with the higher bidder, and especially those who don't have to finance that, you know.
Yarimar Bonilla is a professor of Puerto Rican studies at Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Yarimar, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're going to end our show today a bit far from home, more or less 34 million miles away. Unless you've been living under a Martian rock, it's likely you've heard about NASA's latest expedition to the dusty red planet that's long fascinated us Earthlings. Last Thursday, the rover Perseverance, or Percy, made its harrowing journey to the surface of Mars.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
For decades, we've explored the tiny red dot in the night sky, with each mission getting us a bit closer to understanding its mysteries. But our interest in Mars expands beyond space exploration itself. The planet is also part of our history and popular culture, from the early days of science fiction on the airwaves.
Bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach.
To hit songs from artists like David Bowie. Is there life on Mars? To the Martians invading the big and small screen.
Range 6783 and closing 65 minutes until Mars orbital capture.
Now this is the plan. Get your to Mars.
There's a Martian right behind me.
Or maybe we're on Mars because we have to be.
Nadia Drake is a contributing writer for National Geographic, and she wrote recently about Mars for the magazine's March cover story. Nadia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Why are we so obsessed with Mars?
I love this question. It's so interesting to me. And it's actually the reason why we wrote the feature, because I'm not personally that obsessed with Mars. And so I went into writing the story wondering what it was that's so captivating for so many people, or, you know, what still is. And I think there are a handful of reasons, and some of them are more interesting than others. But overall, I think our obsession with Mars has a lot to do with life. And so over the last century or so, we've harbored some very different but very compelling ideas about what sorts of life forms might exist on Mars. First, that was intelligent aliens who were capable of building a planet-spanning network of canals. And then we moved on to thinking that maybe vegetation was seasonally darkening the planet's surface. And then once we found out that was wrong, we thought, well, maybe there might be microbes in the soil. And so now we have this mission, the Perseverance mission, which is actually going there to look for signs of ancient life on Mars. And so even though we keep finding out that what we think about life there tends to be wrong, we've never really been able to eliminate the possibility that Mars is, or at least was, a living world. And I think that's very compelling for a lot of people.
How far back does our obsession with this planet date? There are scientific reasons, as you mentioned, why Percy or Perseverance is now on Mars. But there are also sort of cultural expectations. And you said that the obsession that we have with the idea that life on Mars may have existed at one point is one reason. But it's also made its way into film, into music, into pop culture. Why is that?
Absolutely. I think in many ways, Mars is captivating because we can imagine ourselves there. So when I first started asking this question, you know, why are people so fascinated with it? One of the most boring answers that came back is that we can see it. We can see the planet. And this has been true for millennia. We've been able to watch Mars cross the night sky since we first started looking up. And even if you don't have a telescope, if you just walk outside on a dark night, perhaps last October when Mars was so close to Earth, you see this beautiful red light, and it takes kind of a capricious path through the heavens. And that's just because as Earth and Mars are orbiting the sun, Earth laps Mars. And so it traces a slightly different pattern than Venus and Mercury, which are interior to it. And so for millennia, we've been seeing this object in the sky and attaching our deities to it. It's been a source of mythology. We've used it to portend the fates of battles or the deaths of kings or, you know, plan our crop harvests. And since the space age, when we've actually been able to see its surface through telescopes and up close with the orbiters and the landers that we now have on the planet, we've gotten to see this alien vista that looks somewhat so entirely Earth-like. Right? Like you can look at these landscapes that come back from rovers and they look like you're in the American Southwest. It doesn't take a huge stretch of imagination to imagine walking across them. And so I think for a lot of people, that's a very compelling reason to continue looking at Mars because we can imagine ourselves on it.
There are people who would say, you know, we've got enough trouble, issues, problems, things that are happening here on planet Earth. Why do we even bother with this obsession? Why are we still sending probes up to Mars for some, you know, fantasy that someone will have? There is a scientific takeaway, if I may use that word, in all mm-hmm. this, right?
Absolutely. So we do get that question a lot. You know, why are we spending resources exploring space when there are so many problems on Earth? And it's a valid question to be asking because there are a lot of problems on Earth right now. But the answers are many. And as you said, there are some very good scientific reasons to be looking at Mars. And one of them has a lot to do with how life evolves and whether we, the life on Earth, is it. And so if we can look at Mars, we see a planet that we know was once very different than the world that we see today. So the Mars of today is arid. There isn't a lot of liquid on its surface. But the Mars of 3.5 billion years ago had water flowing over its surface. It had lakes and rivers and seas. And it had all of the ingredients that we think are necessary for life as we know it to evolve. And so we want to know, did life ever take hold there? Because if it did, that tells us something really profound about the ingredients and the conditions under which life evolves. And if we find out that life never took hold on Mars, that also tells us something incredibly profound about the ingredients and conditions that life needs to evolve. And so by studying Mars, if we get to understand the planet enough, it actually teaches us something about what it means to be Earthlings in the grandest cosmic sense.
So can we rule out that there are Martians out there? Have we been able to get to that point yet, Nadia?
I don't think so. I would be surprised if there were surface life forms on Mars today, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility of a subsurface biosphere. It's really hard to prove a negative in general, which I think is why we keep looking.
And on that note, I think that's all the science my brain is going to hold for today. Nadia Drake is a contributing writer at National Geographic and the author of its March issue cover story on Mars. Nadia, we'll see you here or we'll see you on Mars. Who knows? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Okay, Earthlings, that's all for us today. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. That's anywhere you get your audio. Also, I'm on Twitter @TanzinaVega, and the show is at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.